Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Shakespeare and Company. I can think of no other contemporary writer whose work is as simultaneously entertaining and subversive as Atessa Moshfegh's. Deploying her uncanny gift for voice and cloaking herself in the tropes of genre, whether detective fiction, high society ennui, or medieval intrigue, she entices us into her world, then seeds our minds with ideas so unsettling and sensations so powerful that they risk leaving even the most hardened readers permanently reconfigured. Tonight, we're heading almost back to where it all began by revisiting Moshfegh's second book, Eileen, the small town noir that propelled this experimental writer into the bestseller charts and onto the Booker shortlist. Eileen has just been adapted into a Hollywood film, directed by William Oldroyd, starring Anne Hathaway and Thomasine McKenzie, and with a screenplay by Moshfegh and her partner, Luke Goebel. So as well as diving into the book, reconnecting with the fresh, smart-mouthed, enchantingly twisted voice of our eponymous narrator, we'll also discuss the challenges of bringing that voice to the screen, what it felt like to see Eileen embodied, and the difficulty Moshfegh faced, if any, in handing her over to other artists. In case you haven't yet read the book or seen the film, it's set in 1960s Massachusetts and tells the story of Eileen Dunlop, a 24-year-old who lives with her paranoid alcoholic father and works in a youth detention centre. In her own words, Eileen is a nobody, a waif, invisible. But her life changes forever when a new psychologist, the elegant and mysterious Rebecca St. John, joins the prison staff. It's not often I get a chance to speak with an author about one of their early works that has entered the pantheon of cult classics, so I'm particularly thrilled to be speaking about Eileen with Atessa Moshfegh tonight. Please join me in welcoming her to Shakespeare and Company.
Thanks, Adam.
So I suppose where I want to begin is, because I don't really know that much about how long it takes for a book to become a film. And I can imagine in the sort of the process of adapting it, I guess there are two possibilities. I guess the first one is that you wrote the book, then you left Eileen alone for a few years, and then you kind of had to revisit her and get to know her and the story and the world again. Or the other one is perhaps that it was sort of something, you know, you wrote the book and then this thing has been in the process for the last 6, 7, or 8 years. So I'm just curious to know how it has been for you since Eileen was published and until the film came out.
Well, I love that you called it a Hollywood movie, because it's not, actually. It was an independent film. And I think, I'm new in movies. I've been writing screenplays for maybe 5 or 6 years, and I didn't actually understand what an independent movie was and what a studio was. So my experience making Eileen was a first in a lot of ways. It wasn't the first script I'd ever written, but it was the first script that I had co-written based on a book of mine with a director.
Right.
And it's the first adaptation of anything of mine that's ever been made. So it was a big deal in a lot of ways. And it was also a really strange experience and very atypical. So what had happened was I've known Eileen for a really long time. We first met in, I think, 2011. I finished with her in 2014, maybe. And then the book came out, and I wanted nothing to do with her for a really long time. And then somebody else was going to make the movie. Like, there was another script. And very typical of the film industry is that they got dumped somewhere along the way. And I got my rights back during – is this answering your question? Because
yeah.
I'm just kind of like –
No, absolutely.
Go ahead. during COVID, especially in the film world, everyone was like, well – hey, we can't make a movie, so let's just take a lot of meetings. So I met a lot of people on Zoom that I like meet in real life and don't recognize now because everyone is different, IRL. But one person I met was my director, William Oldroyd, who had read Death in Her Hands because that was the book that was like the book that I didn't tour with because it came out during 2020, the summer of 2020. And from our first conversation, Will said the movie I really want to make is Eileen. Mm. He described the movie he wanted to make. It was exactly the movie I thought it should be. And we started working on it immediately. I got Luke. I roped Luke into it. And it's significant that I wanted a co-writer, mm-hmm. you know, who's also like my husband and my best friend, which is also complicated mm-hmm. as a collaboration. But I kind of knew that I needed someone to help push the story into movie and away from the book. Uh-huh. And, you know, I know the book like weirdly by heart. Like sometimes we would be writing dialogue and I would just be like, it's something like blah, 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 blah. And I would just write it. Uh-huh. And then he'd be like, well, let me check. And it would be verbatim, uh-huh. you know, which is creepy. But yeah, so this is all very strange that it would be so easy. Uh-huh. My side of things was pretty amazingly smooth.
Okay.
We decided we want to make it. We said we're not going to show anyone or talk to anyone about it until we're happy with the script mm-hmm. that we have. It was a joy to write it, to revisit the character and her world. It was kind of amazing to look at some of the narrative pinch points and reimagine it for the cinema. That was really big, actually.
Yeah. I think we're going to talk quite a bit about that, sort of the tension, I guess, between the two mediums of books and films. But before we do, I would like to just rest a little bit with you talked about meeting Eileen. And I don't like it when interviewers do that thing where they say, oh, when we were talking before, you mentioned this thing. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to break that rule, because there was something you said the other day when we were talking about how ideas come to you. And you talked, I think, well, I'm going to do it an injustice, so I'll let you talk about it. But something about an idea coming into focus, or like being in a distance and then coming into focus. And I'd be curious to know, well, a little bit more about what you meant by that, but also specifically in the case of Eileen, like what was the first thing or the first sound or the first sort of distant element that would ultimately crystallize and be drawn into focus as Eileen?
It's weird that I remember this, because usually I don't, okay. because the first thing is so immediately overshadowed by where it goes.
Yeah.
But I remember making my first notes. They were very character centric. Mm-hmm. And I had a feeling that the character was something like a deranged and possessive teacher. Uh-huh. In hindsight, I think that that was Rebecca and Eileen combined, and that I kind of had to, untangle the two female characters to see different sides of what would be the story that occurs when you put them together. Mm-hmm. That's really where it came from. This, it was like the idea of, you know, a teacher as being someone who is responsible for educating you, obviously, but also, has a lot of power, mm-hmm. Has a lot of influence, and a student being someone who is necessarily influenced uh-huh. by the teacher. And I knew that there was something about that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they should be so entwined as well, because, I mean, there is one moment in both the book and the film where they're in the bar and they kind of switch names for a moment anyway. And there's definitely a sort of a sense, I think, between these two characters that not exactly that they're sort of interchangeable, but almost like there's, at least from Eileen's perspective, they're almost sort of two sides of the same coin in a way.
Yeah. From her perspective, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah,
I think that was a big part of it. I think that is sort of what fate feels like mm-hmm. from your side.
Yeah.
And it also looks kind of crazy from the other side. Right. But you're like, this is all some like parasocial fantasy mm-hmm. that you're having. It's not real.
Yeah.
But it is real from that point of mm-hmm. view.
And in the case of Eileen, has very real impact on her life and sets her life on a completely different direction. We just said from her perspective, and of course the novel is written entirely from her perspective. It's like, it's in her voice. We see everything through her eyes. We don't get any sort of omniscient narrator, nobody sort of external to Eileen. And of course, film doesn't work in that way, or doesn't work so explicitly in that way. And that was one thing I was thinking when rereading the book in advance of then watching the film immediately after, was how this kind of, because when actually you read the book, Eileen doesn't say a great deal. Like, a lot of her attitude, a lot of her sass, a lot of her character is in her sort of internal voice, and her external voice is either quite kind of clumsy or quite restrained or quite shy. Was that a sort of a challenge which kind of was clear to you before you started working on the screenplay, like how you were going to get this kind of roiling inner life on to a kind of an external canvas?
So this, that, yes, that was a really important feature of what the movie needed to be, right? And we all agreed off the bat that voiceover was not something we wanted to use. At one point, if anyone who's seen the movie will remember, there's a scene close to the end where Eileen is waiting for Rebecca, and she's, it dawns on her that she's not coming. Mm-hmm. At one point, there was a voiceover that sort of narrated through what that moment would feel like. And it was important that we wrote it. And it was equally as important that we didn't use it. One thing I loved about working with William Oldroyd was that he and I kind of share, we have some overlapping philosophy, belief system, religion around narrative and process. And he put this very explicitly to me, and I love it. And he said, you know, when you're writing or making anything, whatever you do and you intend, you put in, even if you take it away, it will the intention will stay there in effect. And I felt like that was really true for that scene at the window, but also kind of true for the whole thing. Eileen being a woman of few words, she's someone who in the book, like, immediately talks about how much she hid, and, you know, how focused she was on hiding to the point where she would practice looking as though nothing was happening because she knew so much was happening. And I think something that we extrapolated from that maybe was that you only start thinking that you should hide stuff if people can see you, right? I mean, if she had a really good poker face, she probably wouldn't be practicing her death mask in the mirror. So I always imagined her as somebody who was like, you know, would blush easily, would just, everything was like obvious, totally transparent and vulnerable in that way. And that's, so that's how we wrote the character. In terms of the point of view, I will always just keep talking unless you interrupt me.
Hold that thought for the point of view, because I'm just fascinated that you brought up the that particular scene, because I was going to talk about that a little bit later. And it seemed to me, I mean, if for anyone who's seen the film, an extraordinary sort of moment of acting. When you see, as you say, she's sitting at the window. She's not saying anything. Obviously, you know, there's something edited in where you could have tells the story about the fact that Rebecca is not coming. But just Thomasine McKenzie's face at that time. And it really made me think of the sort of the advantages and disadvantages of both the book and the film. And one of the things I thought is, like, you could, as a writer, sit down and describe the movements on her face from it. And it wouldn't land in such a way. There was just something so subtle and so brilliant about that moment, which conveyed everything that was going on inside without a single word. And I found that really fascinating.
I'm so glad you think so. I felt that too. That was a really chilling scene to watch for me. And I watched a lot of, I watched it from a lot of different angles before it was edited. And I think, well, you know, I wish William Oldroyd was here because I'm just going to like tell you guys what he does. But he has this experiment that he does with his actors where, for example, the scene in the bar, which is really the first intimate scene we see between Eileen and Rebecca. And I think the first inkling we get that like Rebecca's up to something, although we have no idea what. He had them do the scene with, you know, the dialogue as it was written. Then he had them do the scene completely silently. So that when he went to edit, he would have like the nonverbal responses in a way that maybe wouldn't have appeared if they were saying things. And I kind of think that was just sort of our approach, that this is, it's so much a story about things being not said, secrets being kept, people sort of deceiving one another, pretending that things aren't really happening or going on. It's like a lot of denial, a lot of shame. And yeah, being from New England, I can tell you that like we don't like to talk. I like to talk, but we don't like to talk so much about our feelings. Are British people that way too?
Oh God, completely. But coming back to that idea of point of view then, so was it, in one sense, kind of liberating as a writer to be able to kind of extract yourself from Eileen's sort of direct point of view? And then did it, was it also partly perhaps in the collaboration with Luke, for example, did it help having sort of a second person who, I guess, compared to you as the person who had conceived of this character and written this character and lived with this character, was always in some way external?
It's weird because the first draft I ever wrote of Eileen was actually in third person. It was in the third person present tense.
Right.
Okay, it was a very different book and it was terrible. Like it just absolutely failed on every level. And I almost threw the book away until I sort of reasoned with myself that it was probably worth giving it a shot and trying to write it from this other point of view, which was 50 years into the future from when the story actually took place and in Eileen's perspective, in her voice. But what remained from that present tense third person was like this slight remove, which actually makes a lot of sense for the character, that she's able to look back at who she is and sort of, you know, judge that other, that little Eileen, you know, kind of maybe exaggerate some things, maybe gloss over some things, and have a sense of humor about the what was probably really painful, and also kind of get lost in refeeling it too. So it was helpful to have already had, as a novelist, the two experiences, being, you know, the observer in the moment and then the character in her voice, in hindsight. The screenplay was in present tense, right? I mean, we wanted it to be in the moment. We wanted there to be anxiety about the character. And, you know, that was another thing about voiceover. If you have voiceover, you kind of know she is fine,
right?
Yeah. Or else she wouldn't be talking to you.
Sticking with the idea of sort of Eileen as a character, one, well, there's a moment, I mean, there's actually kind of in both the book and the film, it's expressed in a different way. And actually in the in the film, it's completely heartbreaking in a way. So Eileen says in the book, she says, if you'd seen me back then with a barrette in my hair, my mousy grey wool coat, you'd have expected me to be just a minor character in this saga. Conscientious, even-tempered, dull, irrelevant. And then in the film, it's not the same reflection, but it comes from her dad. And I tried to note it down as I was watching it, so there might not be an exact quote, but he says to her, some people are real people, like in the movies. They are the ones you watch. Other people are just there filling the space. That's you, Eileen. You're one of them. Which is kind of, I mean, I think for me, probably the most sort of heartbreaking and infuriating moment in the movie. And yet it did make me think that there is, at least for a lot of the book, there is that sense of kind of, in many ways, to, you know, he's not completely wrong in that that is how she is perceived by a lot of people. And so it did make me wonder, is there something maybe, is the novel perhaps more forgiving or more the place for life's minor characters than the movies? Is it sort of, once you've taken this character and put it in the movie, do they in some way become, you know, go from, let's say, a minor to a major character?
I think that used to be true for sure. But I think in both fiction and film and television, we're becoming more and more interested in the marginalized, mm-hmm. non-glittery star, perfect person characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just seems to be generally true. I feel like Rebecca is an interesting character. Mm-hmm. I would watch a movie about that, like in which Rebecca was the main character. But I thought that there was way more potential in Eileen, mm-hmm. as someone who like actually has never been seen before, mm-hmm. like actually visibly seen, and starting to see herself. One thing I loved about being involved as a producer on the movie and not just, you know, the writer just go away after it's done, was that I got to meet everyone that actually worked on the movie, including the costume designer. Mm-hmm. And that I felt very, very important. Mm-hmm. That was fun because over the course of the movie, Eileen goes from wearing really unflattering clothes to like kind of wanting to look like a movie star, mm-hmm. you know? And two, she's wearing her dead mother's clothes. So there's this feeling that she's sort of occupying a space, mm-hmm. like this dead space, and that it's not exactly comfortable or doesn't really fit her. That she's filling in for her mother in this way and not really living her life. Mm-hmm. And that felt important, too, in terms of, you know, the minor character.
It's interesting that you say that Rebecca could have, you know, you could have watched a movie about Rebecca, because in a sense, probably, I guess, 30, 40, 50 years ago, Rebecca probably would have been the main character of this story. And one thing that really struck me when reading the book was sort of how, in a weird kind of way, despite the fact it's so sort of internal, how sort of aesthetically, I guess, cinematic it was in sort of, I guess, in two ways. In the way that, I don't know, there's Eileen seems very kind of conscious of the sort of, or informed by sort of cinematic elements. So there's a moment where she talking about herself, and she says, "No to the nervous hands, a foot tapping, bitten lip." She talks about watching the town roll by like in a movie. She says, "Here my memory breaks down like a film in slow motion." Like, so she seems like her engagement with the world seems in some way shaped by the movies. But also on a kind of, I guess in a kind of broader sense, like when I was reading it, I felt like I was in not exactly a Hitchcock film, but there was definitely, like with Rebecca, there was a sense of kind of, you know, maybe Kim Novak or that kind of character, that kind of look. And so in the fact that then this book went on to become a film almost felt to me like it was going full circle in a sense. So would you be able to just reflect on that a little bit, the sort of the cinematic influence on both the aesthetic of the book generally and also on Eileen's character?
It's a huge question, mm-hmm. with an answer that I won't be able to get to fully. But credit to Anne Hathaway. She's the one who decided Rebecca should be blonde, like Hitchcock blonde.
Right.
Originally in the book, I think she was a redhead.
Yeah.
So, yes. I mean, I think maybe the more interesting – again, I could talk about the influence of cinema on the – like the idea of this being a kind of noir. Mm-hmm. I could talk about Daphne Du Maurier and Hitchcock's adaptation of Rebecca. But I think more than anything, the reason that I was maybe motivated to take that approach was that I grew up watching movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like barely spoke as a child. I like played the piano. I did really well in school. And any other time I was in the basement jumping rope watching you know, one of my mother's hoarded VHS movies on VCR. And I watched the same movies over and over and over again and like was like basically addicted to cinematic storytelling such that it is the form that I imagine stories.
Right.
And I didn't really realize that until I decided to write a novel. And then I started thinking about, okay, what is a novel? I was like, well, okay, I know a novel isn't a movie, but as a character who could, you know, I needed to pull Eileen out of me and my experience in some way. And imagining this character looking at her life, looking back on her life, I could understand her thinking of it as a movie.
Right.
Using that as an extended metaphor for everything. And then that informed, you know, how I was going to form the story, what the story would actually be, how it was engaging in genre, how it was defying genre, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think it's sort of, it just was what it was.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that leapt out to me was the and I don't know if this is conscious or unconscious on your part, but the use of cigarettes and smoking, which sort of in sort of I guess classic kind of Hollywoodian codes, you know, when they couldn't show a couple sort of embracing or going to bed together, like the interaction over the cigarette was used as essentially kind of a sort of a cipher for that moment. So, you know, the cigarette being lit by another one and all of that. And the way I found it quite gratifying, the way firstly Rebecca, you know, her use of the cigarette almost as a prop in the book translated so well into film. And again, there was a sort of that sense of being, of coming full circle, like the sort of almost the use of the cigarette as it was in the book coming home to how it was in the cinema.
Yeah, I loved the scene where there's an important goodbye moment after they kind of get drunk together at the bar, and Eileen goes back inside, orders another drink, and picks up the cigarette butt with Rebecca's lipstick on it and, like, you know, asks for a light in that way, telling us really clearly, like, this is her becoming this woman.
Right.
Like, this is her stepping into this other space, and it's a little bit creepy and a little bit sick, you know?
Yeah. I guess one of the things that occurred to me when, because I don't think I've ever read a book and then watched the adaptation of it in such quick succession, like from almost, you know, within a few hours of closing the book, I was watching the movie. And so I think I was kind of attuned to what differences there could be and what sort of, I guess, reading how my reading of the book would compare with the way the film was presented. And one thing that it felt to me, in a sense, was almost that sort of, and again, maybe this is coming as from somebody who sort of inhabits the novel in a daily basis, was that the film felt to me like it was giving, in a sense, a reading of the book. So there was lots of things which, when I'd finished the book, I was left with kind of doubts and uncertainties and sort of, and I felt there was kind of scope about certain things. And then once I saw it translated onto film, I felt like certain things were maybe confirmed in a way, like nudged over in one in one direction or another. So I think the sort of ambiguity in the book about whether there was, I guess, the kind of the erotic charge between Eileen and Rebecca felt to me much more present in the film than in the book, where I think it's left perhaps a little bit more ambiguous. When you were going back to the book and you were sort of revisiting it and trying to sort of to adapt it into the screenplay, did you feel you had to, in a sense, come down on one side or the other of certain things that were perhaps a little bit unknown to you about Eileen and her motivations or the situation?
Well, there, you know, this thing about the erotic element between Eileen and Rebecca was really nothing we ever talked about. Mm-hmm. And I think we sort of knew that we shouldn't touch it too directly when we were adapting it, mm-hmm. because when you see two human beings interacting intimately, mm-hmm. manipulating one another and having strong feelings, with the kind of admiration and, I don't know, a kind of lust mm-hmm. for that Eileen has for Rebecca, you're just, your mind is going to go to the erotic, mm-hmm. because that's what people touching, like, that's what it is, right? Right, but yeah. In literature, it's much more about thoughts and intentions and interpretations. And in, I think unless you're like, I was in love with her, I wanted to make love to her, mm-hmm. it's, you're always going to be like, well, I don't know, mm-hmm. you know? So I think it's just a different, like, the visual medium is just yeah. so much more in your face.
And you talked about fate earlier, and this sort of, and we mentioned this idea that sort of from Eileen's point of view, not exactly that Rebecca is a blank canvas, but there's, I guess there's a lot of projection from Eileen onto what Rebecca is, what she can do, what she represents. And I found it kind of almost sort of baffling from a point of view of the viewer of the film that was there. And I couldn't quite figure out how, how that was there. Like, sort of, again, I guess it's from this kind of question of the external perspective. Cause when, in the book, you're so much in Eileen, you can sort of understand that what you're getting of Rebecca is entirely Eileen. Whereas in the film, you know, when you have Eileen on the screen and Rebecca on the screen, you don't have that same position from which to make those judgments. And yet as a viewer, I still felt that.
I'm so glad. well, okay. I can't take all the credit, or we can't take all the credit, because I think the casting also did mm-hmm. an enormous amount of work for us. I love Thomasin McKenzie. I think she was destined to play this part. Yeah. I can't imagine anyone else playing it, and I could talk about her forever. But when Anne Hathaway said she wanted to be Rebecca, it was like something clicked. We hadn't thought of it before, but that the star quality, it was like this rare quality of like the last living movie stars. Anne Hathaway definitely has that, and she brought it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was just also kind of like faded superpower that she has, where when you see her on screen, even if you've never seen an Anne Hathaway movie, she's bringing to it so many like associations. She's larger than life, you know? She's not quite human. And that was exactly the way that Eileen saw her.
One of the things that is so present in the novel, and I hesitate, I don't want to say it's sort of heightened, because I think it's actually, Eileen is one of the rare cases, in fact, your work generally is one of the rare cases of when a writer acknowledges how much the sort of internal workings of the body, the influence that they have on how we act and how we feel. you know, whether that be a sort of digestive problems or whether that be, you know, a headache. There's a moment where Eileen felt like her brain was like tangled yarn, her body like an empty vessel, private parts like some strange foreign country. She talks about sort of bad breath, and it put me in mind of the autobiography of the British writer John Cowper Powys, where he's like, he goes into quite a bit about like kind of his toilet habits and things like that, and reflects on the fact that writers don't really deal with the body. You know, like often you'll read a novel, you'll be with a character for months of their life, and then you never have any sense of them going to the toilet or anything like that. So on that point specifically of the kind of the bodily presence, is that something like in your work that you feel, I go almost sort of as a sort of a point of principle, there's something that you include. You feel it is neglected in writing generally, considering the impact it has on all of our sort of behavior.
This is reminding me of the last event I did before lockdown during the pandemic. I visited University of Pennsylvania. I might be getting this wrong. And I was talking about my year of rest and relaxation. And the first question from the audience was this young man asking, I just wanted to know, what about her menstrual cycle? And I was like, what about it? It was so weird. I always think about, I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, I've been a very horror adjacent kind of fiction writer in that I both enjoy and rely on the visceral experience of a story. And I think it's present in no matter what we read. I mean, we're not just brains. We're brains connected to bodies that have nerves and feelings. And I think, you know, in Eileen's case, she is somebody who's sort of stuck in a self-loathing adolescence and going through her early adulthood as though it's puberty, you know? And I think it's a common experience of being like midstream pubescent person to be extremely aware, hyper aware of your body, how it's changing, how it's not like a child anymore, how what used to seem like new is somehow seeming very you. And you're also paying attention to other people and what their bodies are like and, you know, their skin and my skin, you know, you're sort of discovering the more grotesque layer of being human. And I really indulged in that with Eileen, because she was obsessed with it. I always think it's really fun. And I think it was something that was connecting me to her and also repelling me from her at the same time as a reader.
Yeah. And again, I guess a difficult thing to convey on film. But then on the flip side, I guess we have the moments like you talked about, the moment where they dance or the moment when she realizes that Rebecca's not coming. And that's a kind of an external physicality, which is difficult or not impossible to get in a book, but much more sort of one can capture much more efficiently on film in some way. I'd like to come back to this idea of collaborating because, you know, Eileen is, you know, you talked about sort of living with Eileen and getting to know Eileen and sort of, you know, she was a sort of, you lived alongside her, she was a part of you. And with this film, it in several stages, you're kind of handing her over. Now, it sounds like from the way you talk, obviously with your collaboration with Luke and your collaboration with William Oldroyd and the actors, like you, that you invested a lot of trust in these people and you kind of, in a sense, felt, I get the impression that you felt safe handing Eileen over to them. But could you just talk a little bit about how that felt, about any of the sort of, I guess, the tensions for you as the sort of the creator of this woman and this world in passing her off to other artists?
I think it's a good question, but my answer is really boring, and that's that I didn't. And this has been pretty true for every book, that when It's not even when the book is published. Mm-hmm. It's when I show it. I think, yes, when my agent reads it, I'm still, it's mine. When it gets to my editor and the publisher, and now like the team is reading it and they're looking at it as a book that needs to be sold and marketed a certain way, mm-hmm. that's not mine anymore. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can take I'll take all the credit, but I feel completely detached. I will still feel loyal. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone misinterprets something about the character, I hate them. Uh-huh. And
Going back over my notes now.
I'm just kidding. I still care very much when people respond to the actual writing, uh-huh. you know, but people rarely do that. Mm-hmm. That shocked me. As you said, I came from having just written this experimental novella and identifying as a short story writer and being the kind of writer that uses language in a very, very, very materialistic way, like language as material, like paint, thinking less about plot and suspense and things, and way more about like the poetics of a sentence and an image I might conjure. So when I came to Eileen, I mistakenly thought that when the book was received, it would be judged on those terms. Mm-hmm. How well was it written? But no, mm-hmm. this was like the great, this was like my wake up call. That most readers are reading for the story and what happens to the character. Mm-hmm. And they don't even not to say that they should, but they're maybe not recognizing the subtlety and nuance and all the ways that the language is getting them to care mm-hmm. about the character or not care or whatever. I was shocked. Uh-huh. I thought people were going to be like, oh, that passage on page 73 was really weak. Uh-huh. You know, like, oh, that
you
was
could
too
have
much.
Punctuated it yeah. differently, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The comma was in the wrong place. Uh-huh. That's the way that I think. But no, I was really, really surprised that people found Eileen so upsetting.
Uh-huh. But then so you hand the book over, the book comes out, you're detached from the book, you know, it belongs to the reader now, and then you come and you work on this film, and was there then any sort of reattachment to the character, or is the role of the screenwriter different in that way to a role of the novelist? Is there less of a sense of attachment and possession?
I think so, because mm-hmm. you know that what you're writing is not the finished product. Uh-huh. I mean, I think that the script is readable and kind of like its own thing, mm-hmm. but no, we always knew this was the director needed to see, you know, this is for the director, this is for the designer, this is for the editor, mm-hmm. this is for the actress, this is for the sound designer, you know, giving a complete picture in as few words as you can. It was very, you don't forget that. Uh-huh. You don't forget that there are all these people who are going to be reading it.
Yeah.
That need to know.
I could go on talking to you for hours about this, but I suspect there's going to be questions from the audience. So I'm going to just ask you one more myself and then hand over. So if you do have a question for Atessa, raise your hand when it's time and we'll get a microphone to you, because there are people all around the bookstore. So it'd be great if everybody could hear. I'm trying to decide which of my questions. I know which of your books I would love to see as a movie, which of your other ones. Like Eileen struck me as the sort of the most, in a way, the most movie ready, in a sense, for a lot of the reasons we discussed. I think in part just because of the kind of the earthiness and the dirtiness and the violence of it. I'd love to see Lapvona. As a film, but yeah. I'm just curious to know, well, perhaps you are working on other adaptations of your novels, or either way, is there one of the others, or maybe perhaps one of your short stories that in some way feels like for you should be the next movie or the one that you would particularly like to see on screen?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some projects that I'm just excited because they're sort of already in process, like McGlue, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, actually Death in Her Hands, a couple of the stories. You know, I say this, but who knows what is going to happen. But I always just think about what I'm working on now. And I actually think the experience and self-adaptation and then seeing the movie be cast and made is really helpful in a certain way. When I think about the main character in the book that I'm working on right now, like I think that he in a way exists more in the world that I share with reality, because I can imagine him as, like, I can imagine him more accurately. Like, I could imagine someone inhabiting that role. It would be a really hard thing to capture. Lapvona would be really interesting to see. I'd also just like to see Lapvona, like, as a place. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam.
Let's hand over to you guys. So if you have a question for Atessa, raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. We've got one right at the front here.
Thank you so much, Otessa. It's really fascinating to hear you talk about your work in person. And you mentioned the sense of place at the very end. So I was wondering what it was like also to imagine these places, because, of course, in a novel, in Eileen, the sense of place is really important. The house, the attic, the basement, yeah. Mrs. Polk's house, the bar. So I was wondering if you had a say in the movie on locations, or if it was up to William Oldroyd's team.
So thank you for the question. William Oldroyd is British, and he had never been to Massachusetts. So I was like, okay, I'm going to send you some pictures. So I think he was really open from the beginning to, I'm sure he had some associations with what it might look like, but it felt pretty pure. I think he got most of it from the book and then from me, like on Google Earth, being like, you see this dead end street? So it's true that it was very location specific. I don't think I really ever disagreed with anything that anyone picked. But I will say that walking into because we were filming during what was that, like COVID variant that was like sudden and really easily spreadable, I wasn't allowed to be on set. There were very, very few people were allowed on set, and there were very strict rules about it. But I went to the house, which was actually in New Jersey, not Massachusetts, where we filmed Eileen's house. And they were still dressing it. This was the day before the shoot began. But it was one of the weirder experiences I've had, walking up the stairs into her attic and like seeing like the candy wrappers on the floor. Oh, shit. There was something wrong. I was like, I shouldn't be here. You know, it was weird.
Thank you so much for sharing your art. Actually, my question is, do you ever think of writing just a screenplay and not a book to be adapted?
Yes. I am doing that, and I also want to do it. Again, it's really interesting. It's a really different approach to all of it. And I'm trying to have a optimistic point of view on my now like addiction to working in film, and that it will inform and also improve me as a fiction writer. Because I will never say, I'm a screenwriter. Hi, I'm Otessa, I'm a screenwriter. I'm a novelist. Like, that's really how I feel inside. But if I were to just write novels, I would write a novel every like 6 months and they'd probably start getting really bad. Like I might go crazy. So I need to do other things. And working in film is something that's like, you know, I can work very quickly, but then I have to wait because other people need to read it and respond. And then I need to think. And it's also teaching me how to take time away, making things better in a different way. Like, I think when you're, once you decide what a movie is, then you can kind of have an idea of what the script should feel like and how the story should move. Inevitably, there's going to be someone who gets your screenplay and say, well, this is 30 pages too long, because that's like how many millions of dollars extra. You know, it's so crazy to me that people went to see like 3-hour movies last year. I really enjoyed that, but most people don't want that. So this exercise of boiling things down, you know, what can be removed? What is essential about one scene? Oh, well, that's very easy. Just put it in there. Now you've done that work and you can move on in the story. And it's also that you can, you know, tell a more propelling narrative. That's not always true in fiction writing, but I like it, you know? I don't like when I'm writing just for the sake of writing. I'm like, okay, we don't care what kind of oatmeal she ate, you know? The fact that she ate oatmeal every day, fine. Let's get that out of the way. Things like that. I'm like me approaching stories, I find that I actually have more stories to tell in the same amount of space. And that's kind of why I think Lapvona was needed to be told in third person and have like this cast of characters, which is very different from the singular protagonist narrator in Eileen and My Year and Death in Her Hands and most of the short stories and McGlue.
Just building on that, the idea of sort of collaborating as well, because, I mean, we touched on it a bit earlier, but is there, I mean, maybe this is just me, but like I have a sense of sort of the novelist and the fiction writer, there's a certain element of kind of megalomania there. You have control over everything. And as a screenwriter, you don't. Is that healthy for you as a sort of to get out of that kind of the novelist's kind of all-powerful role?
Yeah. I mean, I don't ever feel all powerful. I feel like I like feeling like I'm working. I think that if I had to, I don't know. I mean, it depends on what kind of person you are. But I don't enjoy like the pressure of being like, I need to be great. Uh-huh. You know, like I really wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I would be like, who says, you know, well, fuck you. Like, I would just be immediately on like I would want to rebel. But if you're like, here's a experiment, try doing this. Now I'm curious,
yeah.
You know? So it's more like, what am I finding out? What am I discovering than like, what am I accomplishing? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think I can come across as very egocentric, because when you have a book that you've published, people are debating it, and you know, everybody kind of wants you to fail in a way. Like they're kind of like hoping that this isn't going to be a big deal. Uh-huh. Like just make sure she's also annoying and that she sucks, you know, so that we don't need to pay that much attention. Because everybody wants to pay attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I'm not, I don't bring the kind of defensive arrogance that I have had in the past in certain Guardian profile interviews with me to my writing. That would be so boring. I just want to get out of the way, you know?
I think we have time for, question just there.
Hi, I'm interested in your process of co-writing. And this is based on my experience of co-writing a script with a friend a couple of years ago. And we very quickly found out that when co-writing, there tends to be one person who's walking up and down and one person who's taking notes. And we both wanted to be the walking up and down person. So thankfully, the friendship survived, but that particular project didn't. So how was it for you?
Oh, my God. I want to be the one writing things down. Like, I cannot be the one walking around. If I'm the one walking, and we totally worked like that. I needed to be looking at the words. My brain doesn't work out loud like that. And that's been a cool exercise in practicing working more out loud. I think it's helpful. But the division of labor was very well assigned. Like, I am very controlling about the words that are actually on the page, sort of less so than the movements or the ideas behind them. I just want to get it right.
And is Luke a natural walker up and down?
Yeah. I mean, that was a cool thing. Like, we're very, very different writers. And he is a more expansive imaginator, and I am a more... let's make things as narrow as possible because they have to be specific. And so sometimes when I would have a certain idea and I was like, let's just plod along and get through this next scene, he was like, whoa, wait a minute. And that was a lot of like being impatient and being like, what do you mean? What else could it be? It's this. And him saying, well, let's just, imagine something else. What else could be interesting? And that got us closer to an interesting place, actually. And it wasn't that it was a different idea. It was just that in imagining something else, if you come back around to where you started, you're kind of coming at it from another angle. You can see it more 360. So that was helpful. But it's cool that you and your friend are still speaking.
I think we have time for maybe one more question, if anybody would like to jump in for a final one. Oh. Well, okay, we'll take these two last questions and then.
My question is, because you have so many books, will you ever give up that screenwriter job if they get optioned? Or would you ever allow someone else to screenwrite your novel?
Oh, yeah, totally.
You would?
Yeah. That's fine. That's fine. I feel really clear about the book. The book is a book. It's not written so that it can be a movie. And the movie is not the book. It's a totally different thing in using the book. More as like a suggestion than a reinterpretation even. Death in Her Hands, I'm not writing. One of the short stories is being adapted as, I think, a series. Not writing it. And weirdly, those are the ones that I just, I don't think I'm supposed to write in a way. And like, my mind is too involved. I wouldn't be able. So somebody else said, I'm able and I want to. And I said, okay, good. So I'm very, very happy to step back.
And we'll just take the final question from this gentleman.
Have you got any other interests, like things you read about or like hobbies you pursue, other than film and literature that like haven't popped up as themes in your book, but you kind of feel color your worldview?
That's a really weird question. I would say, first off, dogs, but there's a dog in Death in Her Hands. I have four dogs. YouTube, maybe. I don't think I've written about YouTube. I enjoy YouTube. I like going on jags where, I mean, I don't like, this is just something that happens. I'm a terrible sleeper. I mean, this is really bad. Don't do this at home, but I can only fall asleep if there's like an extremely disturbing video on my screen, like about 6 inches from my face. I'm looking at that, but I like watching, you know, because you can't write 24 hours a day. You can't even write 12 hours a day. I've done that and it makes me not, it's not so good in the long run. So I have to take breaks. And sometimes I will take a break by watching an extremely long YouTube video that's just raw footage of an interrogation. That is so interesting to me. And then you get into all of like the different channels that do it and who's narrating them. Where are they find, like, and then if you find the source video and it's just like perfectly raw, amazing. So I'm weird like that.
I did not expect the hour to finish like that, but I'm kind of glad it did. This has been an absolutely fascinating time. I could have gone on for hours. Please join me in giving it up one more time for Tessa Mesh.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favorite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. And don't forget, if you'd like even more from Shakespeare and Company, you can subscribe now through Apple Podcasts or Patreon for just €3 a month. Links to both are available in the show notes to this episode. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare and Company Paris. All music is by Alex Freiman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.